This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The nation's unemployment rolls are growing day by day. Earlier this week, we checked in with a man who's struggling to find work and keep his spirit strong. The story is getting the most attention on our website this week, and we've got Jeffrey Bennett with us, digital producer for News and Notes. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, you know, a News and Notes listener named James Smith was laid off from a manufacturing job back in September, and we spoke to him earlier. He came back on the show this week to offer an update. So what's been the response?
Well, much like the first time he was on the show, the reaction from our listeners has been swift and supportive. So first, let's take a listen to what he said on Monday's show.
The work I find here, they're saying I'm overqualified. What work there is being offered, and other people just aren't responding at all.
And so to that, a listener named Tiffany Elliott wrote, I can understand where Mr. Smith is coming from. I have 2 degrees, and I'm working on my master's. I have prior military experience, and I also had problems finding work in the U.S. I've been teaching in South Korea for the last year and a half. It's sad that I can't afford to work in my own country. And another reader named Jarrell Solomon wrote this. He says, I wanted to respond to Mr. Smith because I'm a veteran with similar circumstances. I was forced out of my position in 2002, and I've tried to find similar employment since that time. And Smith came back on the site and wrote a message of thanks to all the people who've been sharing their words of support.
It is really, you know, it's always just so important for us to hear from people as to what's going on the day-to-day. And I really appreciate it personally. But what else are our online folks talking about this week?
It's a topic from Monday's Bloggers Roundtable, a report that Michael Bell, one of the teens involved in the Louisiana so-called Gina 6 case, shot himself in the chest in an attempted suicide. A listener using the alias Miss Moon said this, instead of questioning what would draw this young man to the point where he decided to take his life, the response seems to be that he somehow owed the black community for sticking up for him and the other Gina 6 men. Way to show empathy. Hardly anything in life is ever black and white, period.
What about the inauguration? We're going to talk a little bit about that just coming up in our Bloggers Roundtable, but what are we looking at so far?
Yeah. Well, in addition to our coverage, we want every News and Notes listener who will be in D.C. to upload their photos and short videos via our Facebook page. So there'll be more about how and when to do that on our blog and on our Facebook page, which can be found by going to Facebook and searching for NPR News and Notes.
I personally enjoy it highly, and it's great to just see all the people who drop us lines, and I can't wait to see the pictures.
Yeah,
Jeff,
yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from the studios of NPR West.
There are people who devote their entire lives to the study of economics, so how come these experts didn't see this crisis coming? Why didn't they try to prevent it? Drake Bennett has been looking into these questions for the Boston Globe, and he joins us now. And Drake, let's start in the here and now. As you write, economics is an incredibly complicated field, and most of us don't get it, but we trust that the professionals do understand it. So how are they feeling about the fact that they kind of failed to see how the housing crisis could cause such widespread collapse?
I think for a field that is as full of very smart and very competent people as the field of economics is, they're feeling remarkably sheepish. There is a sense, especially among top macroeconomists at blue chip programs like Harvard and MIT and the University of Chicago, that they really missed this, and that while there were multiple economists who saw a housing bubble, almost no one among mainstream economists saw something this big and protracted.
And why weren't they able, I mean, of course, hindsight is 20/20, but why weren't they able to see some of this coming?
Well, in economics, as in many other social sciences, the most prestigious research to do if you are a sort of hotshot, up-and-coming academic is not necessarily the research that's the most relevant to our everyday lives. So it is rather abstract topics using rather simplified models of human behavior to give you clean, nice results.
You write, for example, that they were using some of these economic theories and applying it to speed dating, which seems maybe a little less relevant than what we're looking at now.
For a lot of young economists, looking at the example of Stephen Levitt in particular, of Freakonomics fame, the sort of hot thing to do in the field was to take the tools of economics and apply them to, say, speed dating or sumo wrestling. fascinating but not traditional economic topics.
One of the big assumptions in the field of economics is that human beings act rationally. Is that something that now might be reconsidered in the field?
Yes, definitely. Over the past several years, something called the field of behavioral economics has been gaining support. It used to be considered sort of a quirky field. Basically, what behavioral economics is it's trying to take sort of methods and insights of psychology and apply them to economics to at least temper this idea of the sort of rational economic man. And I think when you see these kind of panics, that only lends credence to this idea.
Well, now there is plenty of situations to study and look at, and maybe this is an exciting time for economists. John Maynard Keynes came out of the Great Depression as a visionary. What do you see as the new hot field of study based on what's happening now?
Well, I do think trying to explain what happened to lead up to this crisis and trying to figure out how to get out of it is only going to drive more people into trying to look at the psychology of economic behavior. I think also just fields like banking regulation, which have not been considered very sexy for a long time, are going to draw a lot more new, young, smart academics.
And what about market bubbles?
Yes, that's also something. Interestingly enough, Ben Bernanke, when he was running the economics department at Princeton, was one of the first people to kind of realize that this is something that hasn't been really understood by economists, and so had started hiring a few smart young economists there who look at bubbles. And I think for a long time, economists weren't even sure that bubbles exist. Now I think there's a growing consensus that they do and a growing understanding that we need to actually understand what creates them and how to deflate them uncatastrophically.
Drake Bennett is a staff writer for the Boston Globe. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Talk of changing the nation's healthcare system is giving some people in Washington a sense of deja vu. Back in 1993, a new president came to town, and his own party held the House and Senate. Tens of millions of people had no health insurance and high hopes for change. That reform effort crashed. Today, the experts involved in that effort say the Obama team will have to do things differently if they want to be successful this time. NPR's Joanne Silberna reports.
In 1993, Sheila Burke was the top aide to the minority leader of the Senate, Republican Bob Dole. She says bad timing was one of the prime reasons for the failure of the Clinton health plan.
The Clintons had made this issue a critical one in the course of the campaign, talking about health reform, but then essentially let a year go by while their task force pulled things together. And in the course of that, you lost the attention of the American public in many respects, and you also allowed the opponents to essentially mount a campaign.
Another problem, the Clintons came up with a 1,300-page bill and asked Congress to pass it. Burke says the health reform effort would have fared better
had the president simply created a framework, given us a set of expectations and goals, and then allowed the Congress to essentially work through all the issues it had to work through in order to put something together that could pass legislatively.
Then, she says, there was the complexity of the bill. Chris Jennings sees that as a problem, too. Jennings was the White House senior health policy advisor throughout the Clinton years. He says the Clinton team learned that people fear change that they don't understand.
People aren't happy with their current health care system, but they aren't willing to trade up or down for anything until they know exactly what it is.
From what Jennings can see, Obama's campaign promises were the right ones, that people could keep what they have, it would be more secure and less expensive, and there'd be more choice. Obama didn't get bogged down in detail, says Jennings, and so far he's not pushing a lot of confusing mandates.
You don't hear about price controls or premium caps, or you don't talk about new government agencies.
Both Burke and Jennings are optimistic that this time around, something will happen. Burke says that's in no small part because health insurance costs more, and more people are uninsured than in 1993.
People are increasingly frightened, and their economic situation has grown worse. But as a result, they are losing their coverage. They are getting sicker. They are more costly to care for. So it's hard to imagine from a policy standpoint not addressing this issue.
Both Burke and Jennings are encouraged by the president-elect's pick of Tom Daschle to lead the Department of Health and Human Services and the health reform effort. Daschle, they say, knows how to get legislation through after his stint as Senate Majority Leader, and he knows health care because it's been one of his issues since his time as a Democratic senator. Daschle and Obama will have to pacify some powerful interests, insurers, doctors, hospitals, patient groups, and they're facing a skeptical public worried about losing what they have. Burke says the public has to prepare itself.
I think they have to anticipate that things will change.
Among the changes Obama has been calling for, employers would have to offer insurance or pay some kind of fine. Insurers would have to cover pre-existing conditions. The government would offer a health plan anyone could join. That's a lot simpler than the 1993 plan, but it's destined to get a lot more complicated as the details get worked out. The challenge will be to keep the public involved and on board until there's legislation ready to sign. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
The Florida Gators and the Oklahoma Sooners meet tomorrow night in Miami for the National College Football Championship. One of them will win the title, but that's not likely to settle the controversy over how college football chooses its champion. Commentator Frank DeFord says it's just one of the sport's oddities.
When you think about it, college football really is a strange duck. Things are just more different in college football than in our other major sports. It's not only the bizarre system used to pick the two teams that play for the championship tomorrow night, a playoff that isn't employed in any sport anywhere in the world. The attention devoted to the top individual award for college football far exceeds that of any other team sport. People start handicapping the Heisman Trophy winner as soon as the season starts. The so-called Heisman Watch is a weekly feature. But in college basketball now, do you hear talk about who the winner of the wooden trophy will be? College football is different. College football has so many more players and coaches and subordinates of every stripe than any other sport. Its finances dwarf all the others. It's also the only sport where a large number of athletes choose to become unhealthy in order to play. The number of obese players dwarfs those in every other sport, too. And really, at the end of the day, college football is more cultural than athletic. Even as baseball became the national pastime, college football was becoming far more important on campus. Football, after all, correlates with the start of the school year. College is back, football is back. People don't think of college football games. They think of college football weekends. The alumni return to campus for homecoming, for football. So many college football programs now are in effect overseen by off-campus, quasi-official booster clubs. This seems to be one of the reasons why college football alone awards so few head coaching jobs to African Americans. In college basketball and in the major pro sports, black coaches are so common now, nobody much bothers to mention race when one is hired or fired. But just a month ago, only 3 of the 119 Division I football coaches were African American, 2.5%, when it's estimated that at least half of all Division I players are black. A veritable frenzy of minority hiring has raised the number of black coaches to 7. But it's invariably the lesser colleges that give blacks a chance. Auburn chose a white guy whose record was 5 wins, 19 losses, instead of Turner Gill, an African-American who had completely turned the University of Buffalo's program around. Of course, Gill's alma mater, Nebraska, had passed on him, too. In some countries, the second most famous man in the land is the national soccer coach. That's also pretty analogous to the way it is in our colleges with football, only more so. The football coach is the face of the college, and a lot of boosters and alumni and athletic directors and presidents aren't ready to see a black man out in front of our football team, our place. College football is different, different even from the United States.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. These are unprecedented times on Broadway. In the next 2 weeks, 4 shows will close. That's after 9 shows closed last Sunday. Reporter Jeff London got together with a veteran producer and a young investor to find out why so many Broadway theaters have gone dark.
On Monday morning, the sidewalk outside the Neil Simon Theater was lined with crates and bins filled with discarded lumber. Stagehands scurried in and out of the large double doors leading from the pavement to the stage. That's where I met Manny Eisenberg, who's been producing plays on Broadway since The Lion in Winter in 1966.
So here we are on...
on 52nd Street, between Broadway and 8th, at the Takeout. It's when the scenery comes out of the theater. This is Hairspray, or this was Hairspray.
Hairspray had run at the Neil Simon Theater for the last 6.5 years. It was one of the shows that called it quits on Sunday. Some shows, like White Christmas, were holiday bookings, but others, like Young Frankenstein, Grease, and Boeing Boeing, decided to close long before anyone expected them to. January and February are notoriously bad months for Broadway's box office, and with the economic downturn, their producers decided it would be better to close than to continue to sustain losses. Eisenberg and I walked into the wings of the theater. Carpenters were disassembling flats and putting bubble wrap around the props.
This is what it looks like. Used to be scenery.
Eisenberg says shows are loading out all over the theater district right now.
There are, what, 7 or 8 shows coming out of theaters right now?
9 shows closed yesterday.
And a few more next week and the following week. Probably coming to a total of somewhere between 16 and 20 since September. There was a time, I think, in the 70s when there were only 8 or 9 shows on Broadway. And that was a crisis. And this will be a crisis as well. And probably a more significant one because the economics are much harsher. Ticket prices are too high, costs are too great. And so replacing what is left town will not be simple.
Since those dark days in the early 1970s, Broadway's 36 theaters have more or less been filled. And there are several productions lined up to open in theaters where shows have recently closed. Revivals of West Side Story, Hair, and Guys and Dolls, Dolly Parton's new musical version of 9 to 5, and quite a few plays. But Manny Eisenberg says investment capital on Broadway is getting tight. It's a risky business where only 1 out of 5 shows turn a profit.
You can ironically say that the theater's a better investment than the stock market at the moment. On the other hand, that cavalier money that was around to invest in the theater has certainly diminished. There are major investors that I know that they used to put in $500,000, so they'll put in $100,000. That's going to affect a lot of things.
While there are those big investors who make Broadway hum, there are also lots of smaller investors who chip in from $10,000 to $25,000 for a piece of the Broadway dream, like Brad Rubenstein.
There was a wonderful song in title of show that talks about being part of it all. And I think that that's the motivation for a lot of smaller investors, is that this is their opportunity to be a part of that life and that glamour and that key part of what makes New York, New York.
Rubenstein has invested in 15 shows. Most, like title of show, were flops, but a couple, like Hairspray, were hits. He says he's still getting pitches from producers, though lately he's been feeling the pinch.
There's less capital for me to invest. That, you know, for me and a lot of other investors, constrains our, in a sense, our vanity investments or our charitable contributions or our philanthropy. All of those things contract with the economy.
Still, as soon as he's able, Rubenstein says he'll likely give in to the seductive pull of being part of it all.
There will always be room in New York City for theater. There will always be an audience for theater in New York City. And so I'm pretty optimistic.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.